Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September the 5th, 1995. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Ed Schrader, and he is speaking on why Jesus and not just therapy to make and keep me healthy.
My name is Edward Schrader. I live in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm a professor teacher in originally Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, and now for the last 15 or so years, no, last 6 years or seven in the ELCA. Marie and I, my wife who's over there, have spent the last 2 years out of the country at two different seminaries, one in Adelaide, Australia, that was all 1994, and this year up until a few weeks ago we were in Ethiopia at the Lutheran Seminary in Addis Ababa. And if you're interested in that, on these two piles are newsletters from our little group in St. Louis about that. This is the one on Australia. This pile over here is the one on Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, from which we just got back. That's got nothing specifically to do with what we're here to do today, because we're moving to session number two of a sequence of five this week called Why Jesus? And that's not a statement of unfaith, that's the question that much of our world today pushes upon us. Why do you Christians still hang on to Jesus? Or what do you have in Jesus that you think we Buddhists don't get from our Buddhism? Or we Muslims don't get from Islam? Or even in a more close to home, the other good news is that many of us have been getting today's topic, like from therapy, from psychiatrists, from counselors who've helped us get our lives together and bring us healing. It's not intended to be antagonistic to these alternatives, but especially since these world religions are now coming much closer to the USA, you don't have to go very far before you bump into people who are Buddhists or Muslims, or in America for a long time, Jewish folks who've been here for a long time. But and so the question they ask if they ever get in conversation with you is, why Jesus? Especially if you are in some kind of mission mind yourself to try to make a case for Jesus to these folks. Why Jesus? So we looked at that yesterday at the New Testament, what should I call it? The New Testament precedent for that, because that was the same question that evangelists and the apostles and just plain normal run-of-the-mill Christians had to answer when they went out to promote the good news that they had heard in the crucified and risen Christ. Fellow Jewish folks, that's where the Christian church started, asked the question then too, well, why Jesus? Why can't we just stay in the Jewish faith? Isn't that enough? Wasn't that okay? And when the mission movement got beyond sort of Judaism or Jerusalem and the Palestine area and into the so-called pagan world, the world of Greek philosophy and Greek religions, those folks asked too, why are you pushing Jesus? What have you got in Jesus that we don't have already? Okay, that's the overarching topic for the week. Yesterday, as I said, the New Testament answer for those questions to the main two questioners of that day, Judaism and Greek philosophy. Today is why Jesus and not just therapy, psychiatry, counseling to keep me healthy. Tomorrow, I've got no session. Thursday is why Jesus and not Buddhism for getting peace and being able to live at peace in the world. Friday, then there's a morning and an afternoon session to get five of them in 5 days. In the morning, it's why Jesus and not just common sense for working out your own ethics. And the last one is why Jesus and not ecological education and our awareness of cosmic catastrophe to get people busy to care for the earth, for the care and redemption of the earth. So today it's therapy and the healing arts of psychiatry and counseling. And Carl, where are you when I need you? He's not here. Okay, Carl asked the dynamite question. Carl, what's his last name?
Fisher.
Right at the end of the class session, and I said, great, we'll start with that tomorrow. Now he's not here. Well, we'll start anyhow. And you don't have a paper, and I can't give you mine, and I don't know what I'm doing.
Here's mine.
Yesterday's won't work.
Yesterday's won't work.
Were you there yesterday?
Yes.
I thought I saw you back there, yes. I think affirming me or denying me. I couldn't tell them. A lot of facial heads.
I usually do that.
You just wag your head. Right. Well, okay. I've got even more handout today. Yesterday, we just had one side for discussion. Here we got two. And therefore, I think it may be best if we just try to read through these 10 points. I'll try not to make any No, I won't do that. And you can make comments too, but let's see how far we go. And your name is?
John.
John. Okay, John. Read the question at the top. Okay. Again, that's the overarching question for the week.
The question, why Jesus? Are there substantive grounds for the necessity of Jesus in order for anyone to live a wholesome life in today's world of 1995? The five sessions propose to examine the good news about Jesus in view of alternative gospels available today.
So I'm using that word alternate gospels, not in any, nasty sense, but in the same way that St. Paul, in the first chapter of his letter to Galatians, tells the Galatian Christians, whom he had missionized, sometime in the past, that he has heard that there's another gospel that has moved in to the Galatian Christians, and they seem to be hooked on that alternate gospel, because they hear good news in there, apparently, that they didn't think they heard from Paul. So I'm using the word gospel also as good news. And Buddhism offers good news, to about 500 million or almost a billion Buddhists, apparently. Otherwise, they wouldn't hang on to it. And in our culture, therapy and counseling and psychiatry has brought good news to lots of people. In my own family, lots of friends. So this isn't out to knock therapy, but to hear and to see what good news it has. And where and how is the good news that we call the good news about Jesus something even better? Even better than something that's already pretty good, or that might be pretty good. Number two, session two, and then...
Session number two. Why Jesus and not just therapy to make and keep me healthy? A clue from the Epistle to the Hebrews.
Okay, the Epistle to the Hebrews comes on the back side toward the bottom. I hope we get there. Would you then just read number one? That's the pickup from yesterday's session.
Carl's question. If the goodies of the Christian gospel happened on Good Friday and Easter, what are the mechanics for getting them from there to me today?
Carl said, I'm a mechanical engineer. I want to know what the mechanics are. And he says, I think I understand why the New Testament says in the death and resurrection of Jesus, there's really good news for everybody. And he says, okay, but that was 30 or 33 AD. How does that get from there to me? What are the mechanics? And he actually asked that word. Would you pick it up, read then? Oh no, you're not even finished.
Yeah.
I should pay attention to my own text.
Answer, proclamation and sacraments to put the goodies of 33 AD before you today. Faith, understood as trust, that equals to make the goodies your own.
I think this is the relatively simple Christian answer. How does the good news, how does the good things that happen on Good Friday and Easter Sunday get to, September 5, 1995, and let's say to me on this day. The answer is the proclamation of the gospel on September 5, 1995, if you're around, into your ears and therefore into your mind and heart, is one of the ways, one of the media, and what Christians call the sacraments, holy baptism, the Lord's Supper. In fact, in one of the confessional writings of the Lutheran Church, the doctrine documents from the Reformation, Luther says there are at least five, there may even be more, but there are five, the three that I just mentioned, preaching, holy baptism, Lord's Supper, and then Luther, as many of the Lutherans of the 16th century said, and confession and absolution, private confession is another way because there that gets individualized. Someone comes to, doesn't even have to come to a pastor, comes to a fellow Christian and says, I got a burden on my heart and I got to unload that on somebody. And, you know, would you hear me out? And when that person who hears out is also a Christian, he or she is authorized by Christ to say, if I confess this sin, and says, I'd like to hear forgiveness. Forgive him. You know, speak Jesus' forgiveness to him. So Luther said that's at least a fourth way. And then Luther said there's another fifth way, like maybe happening here today, when Christians just get together and talk about faith and about life and about what the good news is for them. So the transfer mechanism, Carl wanted the mechanics, is preaching, sacraments, Christian conversation, talk stuff, but talk stuff about the good news, is the way it gets from way back there, you know, to way up here. And then you might say, okay, well, the talk and the sacrament sort of put it right in front of me, so it's now present, but how does it become mine? And there's only one biblical answer for that. It's yours when you trust it. When you trust it. Does anybody here still speak German, or maybe even
Ambition.
For this very point, I don't want to be quoting Luther all the time because he's not the main topic here, but in some of these things he said it right. Luther said, glaubst du, hast du. Glaubst du nicht, hast du nicht. Glauben is the word for trust, believe. He said, when you trust it, it's yours. And if you don't trust it, it's not yours, even if it's lying right in front of you. Parallel would be, I suppose, or one parallel would be, in marriage, not even necessarily Christian marriage, or just any good marriage, man and woman. Wedding ceremony. He promises to her, and that gets said out loud in public, and she promises to him. That's like the offer, you know, that's like putting it out in front. But if the husband doesn't trust the promise of the woman he is marrying, and vice versa, if the wife doesn't trust the promise, and not only on that wedding day, but you know, every day ever after, the goodies don't get across. Even if one of them keeps offering them day after day after day, but the other one says, I don't really trust that. I don't really trust it. I don't really trust that. So that's perhaps a kind of a human parallel to the offering of the goodies, the good news about Jesus, and the trust that then makes it your own. Well, that may be of no interest to you. It was Carl's interest, and that rat, he didn't show up today. So let's move on to the next one. Whoever is next in line, would you read the next one?
Every ism-ology religion has both in its proposal for healing.
And it's both of these accents, that there is some kind of mechanism by which it gets in front of you, and that it, this ology, or ism, Buddhism, Christianity, Marxism, then calls on you to trust what's just been laid in front of you.
Example, Marxism and capitalism. What's the proclamation and sacrament? Is that?
Yeah.
And what's the trust element in each?
So let's stop for a minute and just hear what you have to say. What would you say on that? I'm suggesting that every ism is like a religion. It offers some kind of good news or some kind of help. And I picked two that you wouldn't normally think of as religion, at least we don't initially. You know, we say capitalism or communism, that's a political theory or an economic theory. But just for fun, can you see how both of these isms, one that's sort of at home in the US and one that wasn't at home, but was at home in the whole Russian Empire up to a few years ago, what's the mechanics whereby the good news of either of these isms got offered to people, and what was the thing that you were asked to trust if you were in one of those? Either one, you know, don't necessarily try to find something that's common in both. Well, let's start with one that's closer to home for most of us. What in capitalism are we asked to trust? Carl, we just answered your question. Okay, to trust in money?
The market.
The market.
That was one that came to my mind. You got to trust the market, that you put your money out there for investment, and for making more money, and you got to trust that the market, the play of the market, will eventually bring you back a reward. Or you even if you're not buying stocks and bonds, you buy a farm, and you trust that farming that farm, you can make enough money that you will have profit at the end of the year after year after year. Trust the market. I think that would be one thing, that you trust the market, even though it's up and down and very dicey. But eventually you say, in the long run, I trust that the market will still pay off. What in communism do you trust? Even though I suppose very few of you were in any way committed Marxists, maybe you have been, or maybe you still are.
The state.
Yeah, well, yes and no, because the end of the Marxist pattern is finally a stateless society, and the state is just there in the meantime to sort of move you from this proletarian oppression where the owners are, so that the state is the agent to try to break that open and get you to the end.
Did you have to trust that your neighbor wouldn't take yours, that everybody would throw their stuff in the pot?
I think that is one element of trust, and that's maybe why, the current socialist empire of the USSR crumbled, that they had in Christian language, a false doctrine of human beings. They didn't think human beings would really be sinful. But a grab and grab and say, if it's available, I'm going to take it. But that human beings would be good-hearted. And well, why did they think human beings would be good-hearted and not so greedy? Capitalism, by the way, presupposes greed. It presupposes that everybody wants more. Even if they're nice guys and nice gals, if they don't want everything, presuppose that no one is satisfied with what they have. And that's another one of the things you believe in the system of capitalism. You believe that that's true about people. Now, I have a hunch some of you probably believe that is more true than it is true to believe in the market. Well, any more on either one of these? Either what else is in the mix of what you're asked to believe in the Marxist system or the Marxist-ism, or what are you asked to believe in the Christian, ooh, that's a Freudian slip, in the capitalist-ism?
I was going to say the Marxists certainly had enough proclamation, didn't they? All these banners and sayings and quotations about how everything's getting better and all work for the common good, and it just plastered up everywhere.
Yeah, that was our experience in earlier years when Marie and I were in the East Bloc countries on more than one occasion. Why all the propaganda? What's the human problem that the propaganda was supposed to fix?
Mind control.
Well, before it was even control, it was to change people's minds.
Change their minds.
Yeah. Even the proletarians, even the people at the bottom pile still think like capitalists, in that they think, we don't have any money, they got all the money, it'd be nice if we could get some money, but we don't even have money to invest, and we're then just oppressed by that kind of belief. How many of you have heard the word conscientization? It's a humongous, you have. Can you, just to get you to talk, what is this strange big word, conscientization? That
I heard about it in seminary. I don't remember anything from seminary.
Hey, a guy who is now 65 and spent his life teaching at seminaries, you really warm my heart.
My crosshairs too when I was in. Okay, sort of like being sensitized to the what I got from it is sort of like being sensitized to the reality of the people's situation of like liberation theology type of thing.
It's got the word not conscience, but consciousness in it, and it means to change people's consciousness, the way people just think or understand or perceive things. And to get them to sort of have sort of, a new movie running in their head as to how the world operates, how the world runs. And the Marxists, Marx was really a pretty tame guy himself, Karl Marx. He said, I've been studying history, and he was an egghead. And he said, I see that an important factor in why history goes the way it does is economics. It's not military. Military is often the consequence of the economic, that this country wants something that that country has. Or this country says, I think they're going to come and get ours, and so I'm going to fight with them before they come. But it's about stuff. And that the first sort of change in consciousness was that it's not politics and military that makes human history, but it's this economic warfare that makes history. There are the haves and the have-nots, or the have-not-enoughs, and so they fight. And even when they kind of settle it, and one guy gets beat, or the other guy, or they reach a compromise, before very long, he was taking this from Hegel, a philosopher, before very long, somebody else rises up and says, I feel oppressed by that, or I want that. And so you get this zigzag of conflict, some kind of resolution, conflict, resolution, conflict, resolution. So that's what Marx actually asked us also then to believe that that is the way history runs. And then if you do believe that that's the way history runs, that there are always people who have it, who oppress those who have not, then you could appeal to the have-nots, first of all, to say, hey, kids, that is the way history runs. It wouldn't have to be that way. You could have a revolution. You could revolt against all those people who have it, especially in industrial societies in the West. And you could stop it. Or, even more so, that is the way history runs. And if you now see that that's the way history runs, then you ought to sort of get on the bandwagon and, you know, put your shoulder to the wheel of the way history's going to roll anyhow. And that'll make it roll faster. And it'll roll faster than for you, for your benefit. Okay, I didn't want to get into a discussion of Marxism, but I just want to make the point that every ism, every ology, every religion always asks you to believe something, something very central, and something that really cannot be proved. Or if there is any proof, they say the proof will be when it all happens. So put your shoulder to the wheel, and when we get to the end of the process, you'll see it was true. But for now, just believe it, because there seems to be grounds for believing it that makes some sense. Every one of these isms makes some sense. We'll see that in our next session with Buddhism, what powerful sense that makes, even for folks like us who probably are largely Christian or from a Western heritage, how this Eastern guru of 500 BC, Gautama the Buddha, how what he says makes sense. Okay, let's press on. We're up to what, number three?
The two other Gospels of Lynn, Tierra, Jewish Moral Ethical Law, three.
Whoop, you skipped one.
No, here's, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I try to get it all on this half sheet and everything's kind of compressed, I know.
Every Gospel also places these two elements into a large picture, image, blueprints, roadmap, the big picture. For today's session, we'll draw our Christian clues from the Episcopal to the Hebrews.
Okay, what I'm seeking to say here, and now that I hear you read it back to me, I see I didn't say it as clearly as I wanted, that there are these two important points. Carl's question, how do the goodies get to me? And there's always some kind of delivery system. In Marx, it was education. There's always then something you're asked to believe. Yes, that's going on. So delivery system and an object to trust, to believe. And now this statement has to say, but these are put in larger pictures. Marx seeks to give you a picture of sort of how all of world history runs. And maybe I should just let that be enough there. A larger picture, an image, a blueprint, a roadmap, the big picture. And that big picture is a claim to sort of interpret not just, you know, how is this going on, but how what's going on here. It fits into some kind of worldview. This guy said he knew German. The Germans have this word that's sort of intranslatable, Weltanschauung. Welt is the word for world, and Anschauung means sort of the way you look at the whole world. Now, I suppose most of you would agree that Christianity finally is such a thing. You know, the good news is about Jesus, the crucified and risen one, but from that core, kind of, you know, goes on out and finally gives you a picture, a different picture of all, of everything, and of your own personal life, of world history, of where history is running, of what's going on now. and what went on in the past? Well, we'll see that as we press on. So let's now move ahead to the next one.
The two other Gospels of the New Testament era, Jewish moral ethical focus to get people righteous, Greek focus on intellect, insight, knowing, wisdom to see the world rightly, and then act accordingly.
Stop. That's a long sentence. These are the two things from yesterday. How many of you were here today? We're here yesterday. I want to see what... Ooh, very few. Okay, well, then I better be a little more careful. Yesterday, we looked at the two alternates going on in the New Testament time, when the Gospels and Epistles were written. And the two main alternatives were continuing Judaism, with its focus on the good news is about morals and ethics, God's law, Torah, the Hebrew word, God's revelation, so that people would become righteous, so that unrighteous folks could become righteous, you know, good people. That was their focus. In the Greek world, the focus was on getting, you might say, the Jewish world was sort of focused on the heart, getting your heart in the right place so you would do the right things. The Greek world focused on the brain, the head, you know, intelligence, intellect, to see things correctly for what they really are and understand them, and then to act accordingly. So I put these two focal points from yesterday were sort of the focus of Jewish religion for moral, ethics, righteousness, the focus of Greekism for using your mind, intellect, understanding, insight into how everything works, and then to act accordingly. Okay, so this is what you've read so far is kind of a summary. If this is kind of the two that came from yesterday, then please.
And having continued down through the history of the Western world.
So, and those two options are present today. Perhaps you've heard history books or teachers say the Western world today is the product of both of those roots. You know, the Judeo-Christian root, Bible from Palestine and Jerusalem, and Plato, Aristotle, the Greek philosophical world, the world of Athens. And both of those have come together in Western thinking, Western civilization, initially in Europe, and then a few hundred years transplanted here to the so-called New World. Okay, it's not just that those were two options way back there. Those two options continue to operate all the way down to 1995, and they have their proponents. They take new form, new shape, maybe new wineskins, but in many respects the same double possibilities, to focus on ethics, morals, righteousness, to focus on intellect, understanding, wisdom, insight.
Today's gospel of therapy draws on both of these, but the Greek heritage, the Gnostic from the Greek word Gnostic, insight, dominates.
Okay, you're doing well. Press on.
When either of these perspectives become a way of salvation, we have moralism and Gnosticism.
Okay. I'm probably choking you with words that are too big, at least that they're too big for 5 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. In the Greek language, G-N-O-S-I-S is the word for knowledge, wisdom, insight, for brain smart stuff. And when you make an ism out of that, you know, that means sort of a philosophy or maybe even a religion, then you get the word Gnosticism. Similarly, the Jewish one, who, as I said, focused on the moral, and of course we all know this word, that when you make an ism out of that, you get moralism. Okay, I just want to say that either one of these can become, by themselves, a religion, an ism, a proposal for what's wrong, for seeing what's wrong with the world, and then a proposal for how to fix it. All right, this is all my lead in to get you to the main topic, therapy, and I'm going to start with Sigmund Freud, although I know there's lots of therapy today that's anti-Freudian or non-Freudian, but Freud did something a little over 100 years ago that kind of set the pattern, I think, for what's still true in large measure with the offer that therapy makes for healing people. And so I'd ask the next person to read the next one. Number five, is it? Yes.
Freud, the granddaddy of 20th century therapy, is a classic.
That there's a, at least this is an important factor initially in Freud. I probably say so in one of the subsequent theses. Freud was a Jew, so he came from this tradition of Torah and law and righteousness. So this was his own heritage, even though he said he was an atheist in his day, but he was a Jewish atheist. And a lot of that stuff was in him. You know, he probably got it with mother's milk when she nursed him. Thinking of you with that marvelous statement you made this morning about nursing. But he was also very much an intellectual, an egghead, a product of the Germanic university system in Vienna, where his home was. And so he's pulling on both of these sources for what he comes up with.
Go on. Even though other therapies have modified, replaced his big picture shines through the many overlays that have come after him.
Okay, that's my assertion. Some of you who are therapists yourselves might want to debate that, and we should if there's grounds for discussing that, but I'll press on to just lay this out. I'm saying that some sort of the big picture that Freud gave is one that I hear present in many of the different kinds of therapies, especially those that say you don't need that church stuff, or even that might be part of the problem, not the solution. And I know that's not true of all therapists. I know there are solid Christian therapists who don't make that kind of statement. But the sort of stuff I think that they still teach in the schools is like that. Either because the God question is too hot to touch. You know, it's not PC, politically correct. If you can't pray in the, if you can't talk about God or, you know, Jesus in public schools, if that's very dicey, then the same thing carries on through into higher education, that at best it will be said religion is a private thing and I've got nothing against your private faith and commitment. But here in class, we won't talk about that. Here in personality theory class, or here in therapy or whatever. Okay, now I'm not going to knock Freud or because of its quote godlessness. I think that may be true in most cases, that the therapeutic model operative in much of therapy today ignores the God component. And maybe in a secular world like we are, that's about the best you can do. But first of all, I want to just sketch out here Freud's own model for how to heal people, which would be, you know, Freud's gospel, the good news that Freud proposed, and that for many people he was, and even still is. Okay, the big picture, I'll sketch that in a minute on the blackboard when we get the next two pieces done. So would you take number, what are we up to, six?
What Freud did with his Jewish and Greek heritage added the moral element to the Greek two-part picture of human beings, body and mind, to offer his three-part picture of ID, human biology with its drives and needs, ego, the rational self, and the new part, superego, equals something above the ego that seeks to dominate it.
There should be a parenthesis closed after that, I see. Okay, here I'm going to now do some sketching. For those of you who were here yesterday, we noted that in the Greek world, the human person was basically bipartite, two parts, and I'll just make two boxes. This, the top part was body, flesh, meat, you know, the stuff we share with other animals. And the top part was then differently named reason. I shouldn't say top part. But the thing that was human, was unique about humans, that they had reason, or you could call it, what are some things I call it?
Mind.
Mind, or spirit,
sometimes even called soul, although that's a very dicey a word that has many different meanings already back in the ancient world. And the classical definition then for the Greek world was, human beings are animals like other animals, but they're animals with rationality. They're rational animals. That's a classic phrase right out of Aristotle. And because we've got this, that's what makes us different from the chipmunks, etc., who, if they're mammals, you know, are in many respects just identical to us physiologically and physiogenically. Well, that was what we got from the Greek world. But Freud, I said, put another story on top of this, and he changed the language. He called this id, just three little Latin words, ego. And then he said, above the ego, on top of the ego, there's still something else, a superego. But this much of Freud is stolen right straight from the Greeks. Yeah. For him, the word ego does not mean egotistic. Ego means these abilities and capabilities in every human person. And id is, you can just add another word, id is sort of the energy or the chemistry or even the electricity in the human body. Or, you know, the needs to be fed, to be clothed, the needs for sexual reproduction in the animal world, and there's some similar drive in all of us. And so this he borrowed straight from the Greeks, and I'm suggesting that initially this came from his Jewish, his Hebrew heritage. I don't know if that's documentable, but it makes sense. Because this was the element of something more than just rationality, and something that was something on top of rationality, and that was always an evaluator, a moral evaluator. And that every human being, he says, is made up that way. Now, here's where another Jewish thing comes in the mix, I think. Both of these are present when you get born. That is not present when you get born in Freud, but that's what develops in you as you grow up. That's what, if you will, your own personal history adds. That, you know, you learn right and wrong from your parents, and or auntie or uncle, or the Sunday school teacher, or the pastor. And Luther, that's a Freudian slip. I shouldn't say Freudian slip now. And Freud said, for the most part, this superego is usually bad news. Because it seems always to be a critic of telling you, you know, you're not good enough. You did the wrong thing. Mama doesn't like that. The Sunday school teacher says Jesus doesn't like that. That the moral evaluator never, at least never very long, comes up with a good news verdict. But that it's always the critic. And that being the case, well, not that being the case. And because of this operational critic, people in their mind and rationality get crazy ideas and understandings. And even, you know, sort of their psychochemistry, they get these kind of hang-ups, these kind of, what's the word, complexes, all of which are sickness, or at least they're destructive. At least they aren't wholesome. And often they hurt. And you would say, if you could come to a guy like Dr. Freud, Dr. Freud, can you help me? You know, can you help heal me of whatever it is that's spooking around inside of me that, you know, gives me this twitching arm, or gives me this constant backache, or gives me these hang-ups that I can add and go and, you know, and look at this or look at that, or that I have this or that fear. Well, okay, that's what I would call a diagram of the larger picture that Freud presents. And that's already got implicit, you know, a diagnosis of the human problem, at least in many respects of our human behavioral problems, and also a proposal. We haven't got the proposal for therapy. The proposal for therapy then for healing would be, can you do something about this? That is, this when it operates like that, and that, because that's the cause, you know, that's the root cause. And if you could somehow heal that, either to make it non-functional at all, or to get it to stop criticizing you, or whatever, you know, that would be good news.
I was just thinking that the idea of the critic would be in keeping, I think, I just thought about it, with Freud's Jewish background of a condemning God rather than an accepting one, a vengeful God.
Well, at least, I don't know if I want to go that far, but that's already that direction. That's you know, he was enough of an atheist to say he didn't believe that that was God's law. But when he grew up in that Jewish family, or if not him, then his grandpa's family, that's what they said, you know. The critic is not just mama saying, eat your chicken soup, but the critic is finally God saying, Sigmund, you shouldn't do this, you should do that. You know. Another one of the sort of the Jewish slash almost Christian presuppositions is there is in here a doctrine of sin, namely that human beings aren't okay, that they got problems, and the problem is somehow in relation to their behavior and performance and whether they're righteous or not. Now, of course, then this word gets into the mix. The Bible talks about real guilt. When Freud finally gets done with proposing his therapy, what does this become? And isn't that a common word in our lingo today? That's one of the numbers that Freud did on the Judeo-Christian tradition. He finally said there is no real such thing as guilt. You know, this critic up in your head or wherever it is, you know, may be accusing you and say that you are guilty, but those are just feelings you have inside you, that there's some critic inside you that says I'm guilty. That guilt is no, you might say, public reality, but are these feelings that are inside the person and that often, you know, will tell the ego, tell my mind, yeah, and you are guilty, you know, you are so-and-so, and you've always been that. You never did please your mother. Now that man, and therefore, I am not a very pleasing person. Or at least when Mom and I are together, I'm not very pleasing because it always shows up. You know, we always fight, or she says, "Eddie, you're never good enough." Well, okay. I gather some of you at least get get the feel a fair picture initially of sort of Freud's way of looking at the big picture of humans in the world and what our problems are. Would we move on now? Whoever's next, please.
All right. Religion was no serious component in the Greek image of humans.
Stop. You remember this was the Greek one? There's no real place for religion. Plato and Aristotle are not really very concerned about religion. They're going to say if you do have religion, if you do believe something about the gods, at least make sure that it computes here. You know, that at least it's congruent with sensibleness, reasonableness. One of the reasons they didn't is polytheism of the Greek world had so many gods up on Mount Olympus, and the trouble was they didn't stay up there, they came down into Athens. And these gods were such a mishmash. In most cases, they were just sort of human dimensions writ large, and the gods could be as raunchy or as mean or as wicked as people can be. And part of the Plato-Aristotle folks was to critique that kind of folk religion and to say, if you're going to have any kind of God ideas and do God talk, at least make sure that, you know, it makes sense. But there's no special category for, if you will, the God component. And as you will see as you read on, I'm suggesting that Freud put a place in for the God component, although then he worked it and finally worked it away.
Okay, it was important for Freud. He put it into the superego, portrayed it in moralistic terms, his Jewish heritage. and it was always bad. It was always criticized.
It was always criticized. It always criticized.
Always.
Yeah, the superego was always a critic. So that the religious or God component was always a component who just worked in terms of moral performance and moral judgments. Freud says, since none of us is pure perfect, the critic will always find something to criticize.
People need to be healed from the tyranny of their superegos.
Okay, so this thing operates as a tyrant inside every one of us. And what we need to do is be healed from that tyranny, to get rid of that critic somehow.
To see the messages from their superegos, all religions, in fact, were illusions.
Okay, Freud, I'm condensing an awful lot of Freud's thinking and his picture in these couple sentences. But this is where religion would fit in. This is people's understanding of God as sort of the divine super-eating everything. And it functions as tyrant. It causes pain and suffering and bad health. And Freud then drew on his Greek tradition and said, look, kids, when push comes to shove, all this God stuff is illusion. It's something that's gotten into our head, you know, through Papa and Mama and Aunt Tilly and the Sunday school teacher and even our playmates who always critique us in terms of our performance, and none of us is ever perfect, so none of us is ever good enough. But there ain't anything really out there that evaluates us. At least there sure is no God figure out there who does the evaluation. And therefore we've just interiorized what other people have said about us or have led us to believe. You know, the only reality is that we have is that idea's in our head. But it ain't anything real out there. And so if you set this piece to work, almost similar to the Greeks, if you're going to have religion at all, use your ego, use the rationality to at least frame it and to shape how you're going to talk about it. Freud says ego, that's what I mean. The best definition for ego, it's a Greek word, is the self, your own unique person. And so use the intellectual, the mind in your own unique person and figure it out. Figure out that the only reason I have this hang up is that my mama always said I was never good enough. And you know, that can be documented. Rhea is smiling because we have one dear friend who's a PhD and the chairman of his department at St. Louis University, big Jesuit school, and he's a Lutheran, which is quite a trick to get into a Jesuit school. And not too long ago, we were sitting with him, and he said, my mama always criticized me. I was never good enough. And so that's just one sample. Charlie would be a classic case to lie down on the couch with Freud and have him, you know, fix that. Because it's clear that Charlie's a super mathematician. I've got all kinds of talents and gifts. But somehow in his head is this message from Mama that he says, you know, was said 1,000 times. And he needs to be healed from that. Okay, turn the page over. And would you read the next one, please?
Ego, Freud's term for intellect, inside, was a resource for such healing. Ego expansion, both up and down, was the process.
Okay, I've got this board so messed up you probably can't see it, but I'll try to just get back to these three boxes. Ego expansion means, you know, if this is sort of your whole person, you know, this tin can with three chambers in it. Ego expansion means to have more and more of your reason take over in this turf where the critic is. And more. And finally, if possible, you'd be really healed, at least on this side, if you finally had your reason and sense for taking care of all that critic stuff, the evaluation stuff. And then you would see that guilt you had was just feelings of guilt. There wasn't any real guilt. You weren't worse than anybody else. In fact, you were pretty good, Charlie. Mama made you think you weren't. And then he also said ego expansion this way, because here's where the animal drives are, you know, hunger, sex, thirst. And you can't just let them run the way they want to, which is what our culture today suggests. You know, if it feels good, do it. And most of all, the feels good, do it stuff in Freud's model would be right here. And so he says, you know, expand your ego that way too, so that your mind manages your drives for hunger, so that you don't become a glutton. You know, for thirst, so that you don't become a drunkard. For sex, so that you don't become a, you know, sexual maniac, et cetera, et cetera. For all those needs that we do have, let the mind be the one that manages that. Not denies it, but manages it. And then a perfectly healed person, Freud, I guess, would be one for whom finally everything, you know, my biological drives and the tapes that run in my head from my history, from what's happened in my human relations, that finally my own reasonable understanding would say, I've got insight into all that, why it's there, why it works, and now I can manage it. And it won't tyrannize me anymore. My sex drives won't tyrannize me. Mama's critique won't tyrannize me. That's a healed person than in Freud's model. Okay, press on. Next question. Another question.
Did Freud know anything about schizophrenia and chemical imbalance, or is that too much?
He knew about schizophrenia. He invented that word. But chemical imbalance was on, they didn't have any chemistry like that. And that's coming here in another statement. Yeah, that's one new thing that's in the therapeutic healing professions today. And you know, well, if you're in the trade, you know that's only been around not very long, at most a generation, the chemistry that's going on inside of us when some of these psychological, neurological hang-ups occur. But that might be a good thing to talk about. Press on with this. We're getting close. We could finish, maybe.
Number 9, Freud's gospel finally deserts the Jewish moral heritage and goes for the Gnostic.
No, he's finally gotten rid of the moral evaluator stuff and has just gone for ego, which means insight, rationality, understanding, and manage it with your mind.
All right, his gospel looks like this. The three-part human structure was the fundamental blueprint for seeing what the human dilemma is and for indicating the healing.
And now I'm going to go to those points. What are its sacraments for how to get that stuff in front of you? And how, once it's in front of you, does it become yours?
Sessions on the couch were the sacraments to get the insight into the patient and to make it his or her own. The therapist is the priest, the expert, the guru.
Don't you know guru?
Yeah.
Maybe it's a passe word. We've been gone for 2 years, and we're out of the loop. I don't know what's in these days anymore. Guru.
Who knows the blueprint and then the ritual to transfer it to you. The call to faith is that you trust all this to be true, and especially you entrust yourself to the therapist. You know, you hear people saying, I need to call my therapist, you know. And you're all upset.
Right. And, you know, and once more, I don't want this to be, you know, just, but I think this is just operational in much of the triumph of therapy. Someone has written a book, I think, on that in our U.S. culture. And what I want you to see in these things you just read is how it has these analogs to the Christian gospel. You know, there is some transfer mechanism to get it to you. There's some way to make it your own. And in every case, there's a faith call here, too. Not just, first of all, a faith call to believe once your therapist has helped you understand how this is working in you. And then to trust him as the guru to help you practice ego expansion, if you want to use that technical term. So that with your insight, you can manage this and this, and you're home free. My wife is looking at the wristwatch, and I see we're not going to get done. Maybe tomorrow we'll just do Hebrews. Next one.
9. Therapy Today, 1995, offers all sorts of non-Freudian alternatives, but his blueprint shines through the many subsequent overlays. The generally new element in recent years is drugs that change the body, chemistry underlying many human hang-ups. Here, too, Gnosis is what counts.
It's the Greek heritage on the Gnostic side, namely.
And you do need a high priest to discern which sacrament you need and to write the prescription.
Okay, that may start sounding a little snide, but I'm trying not to be snide. You know, Lord knows it's difficult, but because of my hang-ups, you know. Chemicals are the new bread and wine, or not the new bread and wine, they're a form of bread and wine that brings healing to people. But you can't go to the drugstore and get them yourself. You can't get Prozac or lithium or whatever all they are. The guru, the priest, who knows how it all works, he's the one who writes the prescription so that you then, and then you follow his prescription. You know, you do what the priest says. And by golly, it seems to work. At least lots of time it does. Well, let's at least read number 10, which is the long one. And I suppose maybe we'll have to take some time in the next session to work this up, because this is intended, the Bible study I wanted to do today was, you know, the last half hour was supposed to be this, and it took us almost 45 minutes or 50 to get to where we are now. And it's partly my fault. You know, Mama said I always was long-winded. And once she died, my wife continued. She gets equal time next time. Would you just read the long last number 10? That at least shows you where I'm headed, or where you can head on your own too.
The Epistle to the Hebrews presents the Christian good news in ways that correlate with the alternate gospel of therapy in our day. Big picture, Christians on a journey. Malady, burnout on the tough journey. Temptation, to give up and opt for some Levitical, that is legal performance option with its own healing proposal and its own high priest. Christian good news for just such a time as this. Christ the high priest who did more than any Levitical priest do or even can do.
Let me stop. Maybe we can wind up with this, even though we won't get much give much attention here today, at least to this. The letter to the Hebrews is one of the epistles in the New Testament. Nobody really knows who the author was. It doesn't say I, Paul, or anything like it. It paints a picture of Christians who, I use a contemporary word, who seem to be suffering burnout. They're just getting tired of being Christians, and they're plumb tuckered, and they're wondering whether we should just give up on the whole business and, you know, opt for something else. Or the writer presents them as on a long journey, on a path, and they haven't gotten yet to the end, but they've come a long way, and they're tired and hungry and thirsty, and they've had trouble along the way. You know, they got hurt. They had some oppression, and, you know, people gave them some flack. And would it be better to just stop, turn off the road, and go someplace else? So that's sort of the big picture, image of diagnosis. On the way, tired, and why don't we just quit? To that situation, then, the writer of the Hebrews presents a Christ good news picture. And he does it in the framework of the word priesthood, drawing on the Old Testament imagery of the Levitical priest, who the Levites were the priest tribe. They did all the priests were Levites from that one of Joseph's, not Joseph's, whose kids? Isaac. Jacob's kids, yeah. Israel, yeah. When he got his name changed. And those priests functioned at the temple. And the temple, as the next sentence will say, had a specific architecture. There was this Holy of Holies, which is just a Hebrew word for saying the most holy place. And outside was another place. And regular priests operated out here. There were some sacred things here. But the high priest only once a year ever went into this HH, Holy of Holies place. On Yom Kippur, a day that's coming up in just a couple of weeks down in the Jewish calendar again. Outside the temple then were various courtyards. Jewish men could come in here, Jewish women could come there, and way out here, you know, the riffraff, the unbelievers, the Gentiles could come. So it was the court of the Gentiles, court of women, court of men, priest's turf, high priest's turf. And the good news he then says, this writer, or maybe it was a she, says all of this stuff in the Old Testament was a shadow of the real reality, which is Jesus the Christ, and his being high priest, and his going in, not literally into this temple in Jerusalem, but sort of in the cosmic temple of the world. He says this is sort of a picture in Jerusalem of what the world is like. God himself does have a super holy place where God lives. I'll just stop with that. And salvation would be for any of us to finally get home to the holy place where God lives. And that's even in the Hebrew language for that is the mercy seat. It was actually shaped like a throne, but no image on it, no statue on it. What was inside that Holy of Holies in Jerusalem.